Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Kate Wright and Martin Scott, who, along with Melanie Bunce, are the authors of Humanitarian Journalists Covering Crises from a Boundary Zone. So welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dave.
Thanks for having us.
To kick off with, maybe I'll start with you, Kate. Could you say a bit about how you ended up kind of working together? And I suppose what was the sort of motivation and process behind writing the book?
Well, we've actually been co-authoring for an embarrassing number of years now. I think we worked out the other night it was nearly 10, which is amazing given that when anyone says co-authoring, most academics roll their eyes, sigh heavily, and talk, come up with all sorts of dreadful stories. I think we all work in quite different disciplines. So Martin's in international development, I'm in politics and international relations, and Mel's in journalism, which is always interesting. But it all stemmed back from, you know, when we were all doing our PhDs, and Martin contacted me about a piece I'd done on radio representations of suffering, because apparently I was the only one, and was terribly enthusiastic and lovely. And then when he approached me to see if I knew someone who'd worked in ethnographies, I recommended Mel's work, because I knew her. And so it kind of goes back about a decade. But we are each other's reviewer two and reviewer three, basically. We're quite tough with each other, so that when something finally goes forward, hopefully it's already gone through that sort of critical review stage. But this particular book came about because we'd heard of an organisation which used to be embedded within the UN called IRIN. And I knew that from when I used to work on BBC World Service's Africa desk. I used them a lot. And we saw that they were leaving UN and they were going independent. And so we had a chat with the journalists there and they said, oh, why don't you kind of come in and keep us honest? Come in and see what we do for a year. And we knew they were going to go and be funded by a private foundation called the Jinwell Foundation, which we'd never heard of. So we thought that was quite interesting. And unfortunately, it was like watching a very slow car crash over the course of that year. Because the foundation they were getting most, not all, but most of their funding for was run by a chap called Joe Lowe, who was a Malaysian businessman. And over the course of the year, allegations against Mr. Lowe got more credible and more serious until we kind of had to watch them dealing with these allegations, which pertained to embezzlement from a development bank. At the time, there were no criminal charges against Mr. Lowe, but there now are. It looks as if he was potentially central to that scandal. So we were in all these board meetings with IRIN as they were discussing what to do as these allegations got worse and worse. And we were very interested in when and why they made the decision to part ways with this particular donor in order to keep their own credibility. So it just got us really interested in this whole sort of precarious world of very highly specialised humanitarian news outlets, in part because they seemed to be having such a terribly difficult time, and in part because we were convinced that they were doing something genuinely different that was worth attention.
I mean, one thing that would be useful there, and you flagged this really clearly, is the sense of what actually is a humanitarian journalist. You know, what are these humanitarian journalistic organizations. And I guess like one thing that's really sort of crucial there is the sense of them being different from normal, conventional journalists. And I guess this might be one for you, Martin, because I know you've done a lot of thinking about the kind of boundaries and boundary drawing around this category. So what is a humanitarian journalist?
Yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, so I guess the book, I mean, that's the central object of the book, is to try and understand what they are, because we as part of this wider research, we interviewed over 100 journalists who cover humanitarian crises. And there are those who cover it in ways you would expect, those kind of mainstream journalists who see humanitarian crises as a subject area, just like any other subject area. And they apply their conventional news values to humanitarian crises as they would if they were covering a business or sport or politics or anything else. They're kind of straightforward mainstream journalist in which they cover humanitarian crises when they are newsworthy. And they are newsworthy if there is a clear, timely event happening that's easy to explain, that has good imagery, that has some kind of resonance with your audience, etc. So that's a conventional journalist. They cover things when they're newsworthy. But what we're trying to kind of describe in this book is that that's not the only way of covering humanitarian crisis, and they're not the only journalists around. As Kate was talking about, there's journalists that we observed in what's now called the New Humanitarian and other smaller specialized news organizations that deliberately define what they do in contrast to these mainstream journalists. So they say that often they've left mainstream news organizations to go to places like the New Humanitarian because they operate with different news selection. They choose crises because they are underreported. So why are you covering Mali? I'm doing it because nobody else is. Equally, when you're covering Mali, for example, and the humanitarian crisis there, they deliberately choose to speak to people who don't normally appear in the news. They're kind of amplifying marginalized voices. So they're deliberately doing things that mainstream journalists don't do. And in the book, we describe that what underpins all this is that they're combining not just journalistic norms of independence, of promoting accountability, of pursuing truth. So they have their journalistic norms, but they combine these with these humanitarian norms. And so the idea of reporting the underreported or giving amplifying voices, marginalized voices, is about the humanitarian idea that all lives are equal, and that no matter where you live, if you are suffering, that deserves equal attention, and that therefore we should report the underreported. So that's what a humanitarian journalist is. A humanitarian journalist is a professional communicator about humanitarian crises in ways that are both journalistic and humanitarian.
That sense of both journalistic and humanitarian, throughout the book you use a particular theoretical framework, that this idea of fields, and you talk about there being a journalistic field and a humanitarian field, and actually the kind of the idea of, you know, a sort of a boundary zone that's in the book's title talks to the way that humanitarian journalists, you know, are sort of across these spaces, or, you know, these fields, and it'd be handy, again, as a bit of a kind of ground clearing exercise, to get a sense of not in too much detail, because the book is, you know, really theoretically rich on this, but the sense of kind of what is a field, how does it relate to, for example, the idea of there being a journalistic and a humanitarian field.
Okay, do you want to take this?
Martin,
yeah,
okay, one for you.
Happy to take it. So the idea of a field is really, really useful in journalism studies. Lots of researchers who write about journalism describe it as a field. It's useful because it's a way of making sense of how journalists work. A field is a kind of area of professional practice. So there's an academic field. Kate and I work in an academic field in which what it means to be an academic or a journalist or a humanitarian or religious field, or political field, what it means to what good professional practice is shaped by the nature of that field. So in a journalistic field, good journalism is determined by the competition and interactions between all the different actors who call themselves journalists. So in the journalistic field, in the middle, the best actors in the journalistic field are, for example, the BBC. The BBC would say, and many people around the world would say, the BBC is an excellent example of good journalism. Now, is that just natural and inevitable? Is good journalism a fixed universal idea? Has it existed since time immemorial? No. Good journalism, what it means to be a good journalism, is an outcome of a competition between different journalistic actors in competition with each other in what you might call a field. And the winner, the current winner of that competition, is the BBC. It sits in the middle of this field. If you work for the BBC, you have a lot of status and credibility. People regard you as being very good journalism. And that's why the idea of a field, this kind of professional area of social life in which all the actors, all the kind of organizations and individuals who work in that specialist area all compete with each other to be good journalists or good academics or good humanitarians. So it's just a shorthand conceptual lens to kind of make sense of the complicated factors that shape journalism. The shorthand for us is to say, well, they're in a field. They all kind of agree on the rules of the game, and they all compete with each other to be the best journalist. And they all share the same ideas of what journalism is and should be, and who is, and crucially, who is not, who is outside the journalistic field. So that's what I'd see a field as.
I mean, the point about humanitarian journalists is that they're not at the center of the journalistic field. And one of the things the book does is tries to think about how they occupy or move between, or indeed, to quote the title, are in the boundary zone between two different fields. And Kate, I wonder if you could say a bit about, I suppose, both what it means to be in that boundary zone, but also, and because there are, you know, lots of humanitarian journalists in the book, how the humanitarian journalists themselves kind of think about the boundary zone they occupy, how they sort of describe themselves, talk about this, and how they kind of cope being between these two worlds, between these two fields.
All right. So, I mean, I guess I'd probably start off by saying when we talk about boundary work, often what we're talking about is demarcating a boundary, right? Saying who is and who is not a journalist. So to give you an example of that, we did a previous study on state-funded international journalism, and we found that almost all of the journalists we looked at from different outlets had a way of saying who was not really a journalist. So RT was the common bogeyman. RT, they do propaganda. It's not real journalism. We do soft power, but we're still journalists. So it's about forming that hard line normally. But what we were looking at was something different, which was sort of fuzzy boundaries, if you like, which aren't a neat, straight, clear line. They're grey areas. And I got interested in this area way back in doing my PhD at Goldsmiths, which is a long time ago now. And I was interested in freelancers who sort of popped backwards and forwards, who worked for aid agencies and news organisations. And they were a bit like bees, you know, they were sort of cross-pollinating between different areas, particularly cross-pollinating different kinds of values. So we got a lot more interested in fuzzy boundaries and, you know, what it's like to be a peripheral actor in a field, not at the centre like the BBC, but in the margins. And we came across some research by Eel about thick boundaries, which are those kind of grey zones, those fuzzy areas, which both separate and connect fields. And what are they like? And we started thinking, actually, a lot of these kinds of organisations and people we're talking about, they sit in this area because they have the opportunities which are afforded to them by both fields. But they also carry a lot of risks, particularly precarity, because they don't really belong to one field or the other. So how do they cope? Good question. I often wonder why they do it, because it is such a hand-to-mouth business financially. Often one of the things I would say in terms of how they cope is they're quite supportive of each other. As Martin said, very, very unlike fellow journalists who are quite kind of sharp-elbowed individuals and quite competitive. They don't see each other as competitors. They see each other as part of the same community, this kind of a solidarity and a friendliness and a kindness there. And you do find that journalists move around between these outlets. So if one folds, you sometimes find them popping up in another. But I think those the two aspects I would suggest, this kind of ambiguous grey zone. But one more thing I want to flag up is particularly about freelancers, which really interests me. Strategic ambiguity, having that fuzziness or that blurriness about what you do, can work in your favour. And particularly if I'm thinking about freelancers pitching stories to editors who may live in a completely different region to them or different country, you know, how the sort of strategic ambiguity of humanitarianism or humanitarian journalism helps them. So I'll give you an example. I had a stringer in Yemen who we were talking to, and a lot of the people doing this are not based in the West. And he was talking about, how do I pitch a story to an editor in Qatar who doesn't really know that much about Yemen? And he wanted to pitch a story about organ smuggling. People were selling their bodily organs, and they were then being smuggled across the border into Saudi Arabia. And he said, well, look, you know, is this a crime story? Is this a political story? Is this a religious story? Because the mullahs are all turning a blind eye to what would be haram to any Muslim. But actually, I can't pitch that to an editor because it's so complicated, they won't get it. They will have mentally turned off when I'm halfway through trying to explain it. But if I say it's a humanitarian story and people are doing this because they're desperate, they kind of feel like we might be roughly on the same page, and then they might listen to the rest of it. So in that instance, what I mean by strategic ambiguity is that the fuzziness of what humanitarianism is used by that stringer to pitch a story which they might otherwise not get into any outlet because it's so complex.
That sort of strikes me as a benefit, or almost the kind of an advantage of being, I guess, kind of between fields. And I wonder, just to stay with you, Kate, for a moment, whether you could sort of unpack that a bit in terms of, I suppose, field theory tends to kind of gesture towards the idea of people on the periphery of a field, you know, might struggle. They're not, you know, to give Martin's example, they're not the BBC in terms of, you know, the kind of winners who are setting the agenda in terms of these contests in fields. But actually, one of the things the middle of the book tries to do is says, you know, there's real kind of benefits. And you've given a really good one with the example from Yemen there. But I wonder what other benefits there are in terms of, you know, for the news, but also actually in terms of for kind of humanitarianism and for human rights campaigns as well?
Sure. I mean, I guess the key advantage for the people doing this on a personal level is that they get to do the kind of journalism they want to do. You know, it's a question of, you know, what Bourdieu would call illusio. It's about that sense of, what do you think journalism should be for? Why is it meaningful? Why does it have value in this world? And the people we're talking to are often saying, what we really want to do is have some sort of an impact, you know, bring about some sort of a positive change, but without necessarily being activists or advocates for any particular aid organization. So there's something very value-driven about it in a normative sense. I think the blurriness of it is quite interesting because it means that different sorts of articles are cropping up in these outlets, and often much more detailed policy conversations are being had in these outlets. A lot of the people that we're talking about really are absolute experts, not just in their particular country, like my stringer, but also in the humanitarian aid system conceptualized in a more institutional sense. They know about policies, they know about actors, they know about structures. So I think in terms of benefiting humanitarianism, if you're interested in best practice or you're interested in policy conversations in a more sophisticated sense, these are the kind of outlets you should be reading, to be honest, because that's where those conversations are happening.
Yeah, can I just add a little bit more? But I think just as you were speaking, Kate, I was recalling some of the conversations we had, and I guess I'd like to emphasise the frustration that some of these journalists feel with dominant mainstream journalistic practices. If you only cover humanitarian crises when they are newsworthy, then most of the time you don't cover humanitarian crises. CARE International recently released a report of the top 10 underreported humanitarian crises in the world, and does so every year. And there are large swathes of humanity and large-scale crises happening around the world, which very few people know about because they're not newsworthy and because a conventional journalistic funding model doesn't allow for regular news coverage of those things. And humanitarian journalists were happy to take the hit of precariousness to not be mainstream journalists and to lose a degree of credibility and financial security associated with those things, so that they could report humanitarian crisis. A few recent statistics from the UN. The UN this year needs over $50 billion to cover the humanitarian needs of over 330 million people. That's an increase of 25% from last year. So humanitarian needs are escalating rapidly, driven by climate change and other effects, pandemics, etc. And yet these needs are rarely met, on average being about 50% funded. And the idea that that's okay because these things aren't newsworthy is not enough for these journalists. And that's why they go to the boundary zone or become humanitarian journalists and are happy to take the cut in their perhaps pay or terms and conditions or precariousness. Not always, but in general, there's a sense that it's a bit more challenging to be a humanitarian journalist. They're willing to do that because it means that they can report on what they see and what is a really important issue.
I mean, you've neatly set up there actually two questions, one of which is the title of one of the chapters. And maybe I'll ask the first one to you, Martin, and then pose the second one to Kate. So first of all is, would it help if we saw humanitarian journalists and humanitarian journalism as a field in itself, you know, if it had this own kind of unique sort of status, which meant that it wasn't, you know, as you've described, subject to particular kinds of precarity, it wasn't peripheral to mainstream journalism, it was, you know, perhaps funded in different ways with different kind of, you know, organisational setups, different sources of revenue, different kinds of status for particular practices, again, to think back to Kate's example that she gave us earlier. So is it becoming a field in the making? Would that be a good thing, you know, or actually are there problems when things get to be fields on their own?
Yeah, it's a great question. So is it a boundary zone or why isn't it just a field? I guess we conclude in the book that it isn't a field. There is no field of humanitarian journalism. It is a precarious, peripheral, relatively rare practice. It is at a boundary zone. It's not a field. Why? Lots of reasons. One of them is because most of the people we spoke to did not self-identify as humanitarian journalists. Despite the name of the book, that's our name. We're calling them humanitarian journalists. They didn't say to us, "Hello, I am a humanitarian journalist. This is how I do my practice." That's what came from our analysis of them. When we listened to enough, and did enough interviews with enough of these journalists who described their work in similar ways, it seemed very clear to us that there are these professional communicators who are describing their professional practices in ways that combine journalistic and humanitarian norms. So it seems to us, looks like they're humanitarian journalists, but we're really the only people using that. So it does not exist as a field at the moment, or at least it didn't when we finished our data collection a few years ago. I think there is a case for saying it may be that may be changed since we finished data collection. For example, the New Humanitarian is a kind of the biggest news organization in this particular area, and it has a lot more funding, has a lot more staff, has a lot more status and credibility. It may be the exception rather than the rule, but perhaps there is a growing field here of humanitarian journalism. Now, the second part of your question is that a good thing? Should there be a field of humanitarianism? Gosh, I guess at the premise of our book is that if the only way that humanitarian crises are being covered is through conventional mainstream journalistic norms, there is a problem with that. The problem is that humanitarian crises are scarcely covered. When they are, they're usually covered through a charity frame. Only a small number of those crises get covered, and they're usually covered from the perspective of a small number of powerful actors. And that's a problem. That is a very well-documented problem of how journalism generally communicates about humanitarian crises. So any kind of plurality, the addition of alternative ways of covering humanitarian crises, I think the premise of us writing that book is that that's a good thing. That's not to say that humanitarian journalists themselves don't have their own blind spots. We're not saying that humanitarian journalism is inherently better than mainstream journalism. We're definitely not saying that. There is, just to finish up my point, they have their own blind spots. For example, the humanitarian norm of do no harm could contradict with the journalistic norm of accountability and watchdog. So some of the humanitarian journalists we spoke to were, you know, admitted themselves that there was a danger that they might be not as critical of the industry as they should be, because they didn't want to, they basically do no harm. So there's I guess pros and cons of mainstream journalistic practice and humanitarian journalistic practices, but to only have one is a problem.
I mean, just very sort of finally, before I come back to Kate, I just wonder if you could sort of slightly extend that discussion of the sort of pros and cons of a field into this question of how can we support humanitarian journalism better? Because obviously, you know, as you say in the book, you know, you're critical, obviously, you know, it's an academic analysis, but it's clear, you know, this is a good thing. Humanitarian journalism is a good thing. We need more of it. We need to support it properly. So how could we do that?
Yeah, okay. I guess just briefly, thanks for the question. I guess as academics, we're not trying to say this is how the world should be. We're trying to say, we're trying to kind of critique the conventional practices and ask, are there alternatives? And so for audiences, we want audiences to know that there are other sources of journalism, professional journalism out there that you can consume. If you want to find out about humanitarian crisis, The New Humanitarian, DevEx, Human Angle, Interpress Service, follow freelancers in these countries. There are a range of other good practices around there that you can consume. For donors, and we're talking about government donors and philanthropic foundations, private foundations, their decision making about where they give their money to support independent journalism, independent international journalism, is crucial. Most of the New Humanitarians funding comes from private foundations and bilateral donors. And for those donors to accept that this journalism would often not exist without them is important. And for them to make decisions about what kinds of journalism to support, I guess that's what we'd encourage them to do. That finally, the wider point here is that journalism in general is facing an economic crisis. There are no, most forms of journalism do not have an obvious, clear economic model. Journalism in general is financially in trouble. And we think humanitarian journalism about humanitarian crisis, often bears the brunt of that economic crisis. So in thinking about new financial models for journalism, we would encourage people to pay particular attention to international journalism. What kinds of funding models are there to support good communication practices about crucial events around the world? And so that's a conversation for audiences, that's for donors, that's for subscribers. And finally, while I finally have the mic, if a journalist says to you that they didn't cover humanitarian crisis because they're simply not newsworthy, I hope the book can allow a pushback on that. It is not inevitable that 330 million people around the world needing humanitarian assistance is just not news. News is a social construct shaped by economic and political forces, and there is another way.
Martin's really set up the urgency of the book's analysis, and it strikes me as a way of concluding. There's also a question in terms of where you go next, and to come back, you know, to where we started, the first question about both the kind of the writing relationship, but also, I guess, the kind of project relationship that the three of you have got. And so where next for kind of, you know, the work, and where next in terms of writing too?
I mean, I think the big thing we're concentrating on at the moment is impact, which is an awful academic term for trying to make sure that people who could actually use your research know about it. So we've been asked down to meet the UK Shadow Foreign Secretary next month, David Lammy. So we'll be interested to see why he wants to know what we've been doing, what he wants to find out. I think certainly any possibility that we could raise the profile of some of the outlets we've been working with would be welcome in terms of, who knows, maybe even preparing Labour to move into government, who knows. The other thing we've been doing, which kind of comes from the project, but it's not specifically about this book, was looking at the impact of news about humanitarian issues on political decision making. And we did a piece which looked at the 16 top humanitarian donors, that is governments, and what influenced their decision making in relation to media, what kinds of influence media exerted on their allocation of humanitarian aid, and in what kind of circumstances that influence was most felt. Because we felt it really was high time to move on, even from critiques of CNN Effect, to think about media in a more complex way and governance in a more complex way. So we were looking at the role of bureaucrats in particular. And, of course, all UN agencies want to find out about what we found. You know, what makes governments give more is kind of the $70 million question for them at the moment. So we're working with UN agencies, the European body ECHO and ICRC, to find out whether their humanitarian strategies might benefit from knowing about what affects governments. Did it really help governments give more or not? And then I think as sort of a different departure for us, we've started working a lot more on media freedom. So Martin and Mel have got a new project on that. And I've been lead authoring a book we're writing together, which is about a different sort of economic model. It's about the politicization of the Voice of America network under Trump. And we got interested in Voice of America because it was one of the mainstream news outlets that did cover a lot of humanitarian news. So we sort of knew them from that. But when a quite well-publicized controversy emerged about the leadership of a man called Michael Pack, who was the Trump appointee to the federal agency in which VOA is embedded, we sort of went to them and said, look, we'd really like to find out some more about what happened here in terms of helping us understand the politicization of international public service media. So after quite a lot of lawyerly, as in conducted through lawyers, debates and contracts, they agreed to give us interviews with all of their top managers and a good sample of their journalists. And we also got hold of seven different archives, which were compiled through Freedom of Information requests, which included a lot of the emails which went backwards and forwards between Michael Pack, White House officials, conservative media, and of course journalists, so we can actually see what was going on behind the scenes. So that's the book that we are writing next.